Hello and welcome to Academic Perspectives. I'm Ana Fonseca and our guest today is Dr. Alfredo Saad Filho. Dr. Alfredo Saad Filho is a professor of political economy and international development at King's College in London, England. Today, we will be talking about his article, From COVID-19 to the End of Neoliberalism, published in 2020 in the academic journal Critical Sociology. Dr. Alfredo Saad Filho, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ana, for the invitation.
Your article highlights how the COVID-19 pandemic has made evident the shortcomings of neoliberal policies. I wonder if you can talk more about this.
I believe that we can examine the pandemic from several different angles. My angle is that this is a pandemic with neoliberal characteristics. It is a pandemic that has features that are typical of our current age of neoliberalism, and the ways in which the pandemic has been addressed in a significant number of countries also have to do with the domination, the hegemony of neoliberalism, particularly in the West, but in other parts of the world as well. This is a pandemic that emerges after four decades in which neoliberalism dominates most of the world and has degraded state policymaking capacity and health systems around the world. It's a pandemic that comes into being when nature is increasingly taken over by commercial activity, where animal markets emerge and are popular, where the circulation of goods and services and people and animal products and other natural resources takes hold all over the world. So the virus already existed in the wild for a considerable time before. This is a matter for medical doctors and virologists, but it seems that the evidence points to the fact the virus already existed for a long time. It came into contact with humans at a particular moment in time, and it comes into contact with health systems that are fragile, states that are fragile, commercial routes that are, together with tourism routes, the routes by which the virus spreads all over the world. And then once the pandemic is established, it is confronted in different ways by different states, different countries, some of which adopt more strongly, more typically neoliberal policies, and others adopt less clearly neoliberal policies. No surprises there. The countries that are the least successful addressing the virus, the countries where the greatest human tragedies have occurred and are still occurring as we speak, are the countries more closely aligned with an authoritarian modality of neoliberalism. The countries where health systems were disabled, the countries where populations were more unprotected, the countries where a precarious working class did not have easy access to public health systems, countries where states did not have the capacity, the will, the determination, the instruments to address the health emergency that they were confronting, countries where pointless debates about herd immunity took place at the beginning of the pandemic, countries where denialism of science took hold and delayed their response. All these elements and more are typical of the age of neoliberalism in which we live. So in this sense, it's a pandemic that has neoliberal characteristics in terms of when it emerges and in terms of how it is confronted. And the more neoliberal countries failed most spectacularly in the basic duty of governments, which is to protect life and to protect livelihoods.
And for example, in the case of certain healthcare systems that were already fragile before the pandemic hit, as you just mentioned, how did neoliberalism lead to these healthcare systems being unable to deal with the pandemic more specifically?
That will depend on country by country. In some cases, case of the UK, case of Brazil, cases that I know relatively better, these public health systems where health services exist and are free at the point of use for those who wish to use them. There's a parallel private health system in both countries, much larger in Brazil than in the UK, but there is a public system. Those systems had simply been starved of funds. Capacity had been withdrawn. Services were not available for lack of resources. So it was a problem of resource. In other cases, case of the United States being the most typical, it is the lack of a minimally suitable public health system in that country. Completely disarticulated, disintegrated, private-led system for profit, where populations are at the mercy of the provision of services by for-profit corporations. And suddenly, when they are confronted with this pandemic, picture this, a health system that suffers tremendous financial losses. And several health providers in the United States, in several hospitals, nearly go bankrupt before the public sector steps in because of the pandemic. And the reason is, not because they weren't needed, but they were being needed by the wrong kind of patient. Because hospitals and for-profit health providers, they make money out of particular kinds of procedures, particularly aesthetic procedures, plastic surgeries, expensive procedures. They do not make money out of saving people's lives in a pandemic. They lose money doing that, so they don't like it. But what do? They ask for money from the public sector. That's what they do. So in different ways, in each country will have a particular configuration of factors. Few health systems performed especially well and showed significant resilience. But more public health systems, more regulated, better provided, with greater spare capacity, which is, in inverted commas, wasted in normal times, just to keep capacity available, take the case of Germany, for example, those health systems perform better because when there is peak demand, either you have the capacity to look after your own population or you don't. And some of the disasters that we saw unfolding, not only in poor countries, but in rich countries like Italy and even the United States at specific points in time, those were systems that had been degraded, that had been confirmed, that had been limited, that had been restructured in neoliberal times. So neoliberalism in this sense, it is incompatible with a robust public health system, and the vulnerabilities show in the form of tension in health provision and excess deaths.
So you are saying that the privatization of different healthcare systems led to these specific healthcare systems being unable to deal with the pandemic, which is a characteristic of neoliberalism, right? The privatization of public services.
And privatization of public services can happen in different ways. Take the case of the health system in the United Kingdom, the National Health Service. That is responsible for well over 90% of our health provision in the country. It is nominally a public system in the sense that you can go to a hospital, you can see a doctor, you do not have to pay anything as a patient. But the system internally, the system has been extensively privatized. Services are purchased from for-profit corporations, provided for free for the patient. But behind this front line of free service provision, it is extensive, the level to which for-profit corporations, including not only sometimes US-owned health corporations, own parts of the National Health Service in the UK, but also hedge funds. So it is a service that has been corroded from within. That is the case of the UK. In the case of the United States, it's an overtly private health system. In the case of Germany, there are corporations providing health, but they are non-profit corporations. There's minor competition at the margin, and the quality of service is very good, probably better than in most other parts of the world. So there are different features, different ways in which neoliberalism will affect health provision. And that will depend on political factors, institutional factors, the law, and a whole number of factors. But what I think we can draw as a lesson from this pandemic is that more neoliberalized health systems are less centralized, less resilient, less able to respond to the emergency, and less able to save lives, which has to be the bottom line for any health system. That's how you evaluate how effective they are. And in that case, more privatized health systems have failed miserably at a tremendous cost for their populations.
You made mention of the term herd immunity earlier in our conversation. And since the beginning of the pandemic, we have heard the term, quote-unquote, herd immunity over and over. A year into the pandemic, and with the rollout of vaccinations across the world, we hear this idea of achieving herd immunity even more so. Your article problematizes such an idea because of the origins of it, and also because such a strategy of herd immunity pretty much shows the inhumanity of neoliberalism. Can you speak further on this point?
The debate about herd immunity is also a debate that is very closely related with neoliberalism. It's a debate that emerged in more neoliberalized and more individualistic societies. It's a debate that took hold in the United Kingdom, in the United States, in Brazil, in Sweden, remarkably. And the philosophy is fairly simple, just mostly, but not necessarily with the flu. You just let it rip through society and people catch the flu and they get better and that's it. And they develop immunity at least to that particular type of flu virus. Why not do the same thing with the coronavirus? Now, that was a fundamental mistake, a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of the coronavirus, of the lethality associated with the pandemic, and a tremendous misunderstanding of the ways in which society would be inevitably disarticulated as a very severe illness spread uncontrolled through society. This was a terrible mistake. Now, it led to the construction of a completely invented trade-off between health and the economy, with the argument that if you let the virus run through society, so building a herd immunity term, by the way, a term that was used previously much more commonly in the management of herd animals, not in the control of human diseases. If you let it go throughout society, then you're protecting the economy. On the other hand, if you try to protect health by closing down the economy, then the economic cost would be very significant and perhaps too high. Now, this was a fundamental misunderstanding of the relationship between health and the economy. And what became clear in the following months is that if there is no certainty of health, if a significant proportion of the population is afraid of death because of a lethal virus, then the economy will not function. There is no linear trade-off that you can choose a point on a continuum between health and the economy. Which one do you protect the most? Where do you align yourself? There is no trade-off like this. And the experiences of success confronting the virus, invariably, however different they may be, and they are very, very different in China, in South Korea, in Taiwan, in Singapore, in Kerala State, in India, in different parts of the world, the experiences of success, experiences where health policy went very strongly to suppress the virus, to eliminate it at a short-term cost, but eliminate the virus and then get life back to normal. Why has this not been possible in the world today? Because the more neoliberal governments in particular, the more individualistic governments and societies accepted this notion of herd immunity, debated it at length at the beginning of the pandemic while the virus took hold of their societies and spread around the world, and then created reservoirs of mutations for the virus itself that risk now very late. Well, one, you cannot eliminate the virus very easily anymore, and two, you risk creating a perpetual mutation machine within the spread of the coronavirus itself. That may, at the moment, we are still being relatively fortunate in the sense that the vaccines that have been developed recently, they continue to be effective, perhaps a little bit less effective against the mutations that have emerged recently. But who knows if this will continue to be the case in the future. So the debate about herd immunity, it appears to be inhumane, and it is. It was misconceived because there is no linear trade-off between health and the economy as was conceptualized by the proponents of this type of health policy. It also created an impossible dilemma for societies in the sense that whatever virus is left out there and we have plenty of it these days, risks mutating into something else potentially much more dangerous. But this was not entirely an insane debate motivated by human stupidity or avarice, because some people wanted to make profits and so they wanted the economy to continue working so they could produce and sell commodities. No, there was a real basis for this debate, and the real basis and the mass support that in some countries, again, spectacularly Brazil and the United States, even more than other countries, the mass base supporting this type of policy is because of neoliberalism once again. Not just the rich entrepreneurs who could protect themselves and wouldn't care about the majority of the population. If some people die, so they die, as was attributed to Dominic Cummings, the senior advisor to UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. But there was a significant number of people with insecure jobs or working in the informal sector that saw very clearly that an economic lockdown would mean that they would starve. Their income would go down to zero. And in these circumstances of a neoliberalized welfare state that is incomplete, precarious, insufficient, and does not guarantee even life, much less health, then in those circumstances, some people, quite understandably, I disagree, but it's quite understandable that they would say, no, don't close the economy, I'll take the risk. I'll take the risk and go to work because I have to feed my family. Completely understandable. And then, if you tell people to lock down and go back home, but which home? A home that in many cases, in our very unequal societies, in many cases that would imply an unsuitable home, overcrowded, with insufficient facilities, and in poor countries, not enough water, not sufficient sewage, not enough food, because you've lost your income. So the health policy has to be seen as a totality that guarantees life. It guarantees medical care, but that is just one aspect of it. Now we see in circumstances of the pandemic that health policy has much more than what was conceptualized by the proponents of the herd immunity idea. Health policy is total policy, is the guarantee not just of health, but also of housing, of employment, of income, is the guarantee of schooling for children, is the guarantee of everything that makes life possible in contemporary societies. Neoliberalism, once again, has been very bad at this because it tends to care about the rich who have all those things by virtue of being rich, of being privileged, and do not care about those who do not have access to those conveniences and necessities of life. So once again, neoliberalism as a mode of living that we have today that dominates our world shows itself to be incompatible with decent lives and with protected lives. And not by coincidence then, the more neoliberal countries, the more authoritarian neoliberal governments are associated with the highest death tolls in the world. A catastrophe, an absolute disaster that we have been witnessing for the past year, in horror and in shock, losing people that all of us know, all of us have lost. And there is a cause for this. And the cause is in the realm of politics. It is in the realm of economics, not just in the realm of health.
I see how the notion of herd immunity was quite cruel and inhumane at the beginning of the pandemic for the reasons that you just explained. And in addition to the term that is used to refer to this kind of immunity, especially in English. For example, in other languages, particularly Spanish, I have noticed that the main term used to refer to this kind of collective immunity is inmunidad de grupo, which translates as group immunity. There are some cases where the term herd immunity is still used in Spanish, but most of the time, the term that I have found they use to refer to it is group immunity or population immunity. So I was thinking how it's also a language issue. I wonder how that would change, how the connotation of this term changes once we call it more group immunity, which refers to this idea of the collective that, for example, right now, in the context of vaccination especially, we see how, yes, it is an individual effort to get vaccinated, but with the aim of protecting the collective, especially those that lack immunity or cannot be immune because of certain conditions, for example, an immunodeficiency, etc. So I was wondering how, in the context of vaccination right now, this turn of population immunity or group immunity can also be seen as, yes, an individual effort, but aimed at protecting the collective, which contradicts the whole idea of neoliberalism.
I think you're absolutely right. It has to be seen in this way. And you are also right that the term group immunity is much more positive than herd immunity. Herd immunity is taken straight from veterinary sciences. Vaccination is not the same thing as eating an apple. If I choose to eat an apple or not, that's an entirely private act that doesn't affect anybody else. It's no one's business. But choosing to take a vaccine is not an individual act only, because taking the vaccine protects myself, but it also protects other people. So there's an externality involved. There's an external consequence to your private act that does not exist in the case of eating an apple. So it does create a problem for neoliberal ideology, certainly. Anything that involves an externality, that involves consequences that affect other people indirectly, not just yourself, creates a problem for neoliberal mindset and for neoliberal ideology. Neoliberal ideology is about individualism and the individualization of choice and consequence. So you choose to go to the cinema, it is your business. You choose to have a holiday, you choose to save money, you choose to do this and that and the other. These are entirely private acts, and within neoliberal ideology, they lead to efficient allocation of resources and the efficient functioning of the economy. Now, this reasoning breaks down once you have externalities and once, in particular, in this case, once you have pandemics, because then you realize that human societies are not just aggregates of self-sufficient individuals. Human societies exist at a different level than the individuals, and they exist prior to the individuals, and relations between people are primary to our individual wishes, preferences, and decisions. So you need to understand what neoliberalism cannot reach in order to address the pandemic and in order to even conceptualize health policy, much more to implement efficient health policies. Neoliberalism cannot touch in this domain of the collective. From a neoliberal perspective, the possibility of illness is my business. I protect myself as best I can. If I am sufficiently rich, I take my yacht and I go to the Caribbean and I stay in the sea for the next year and I look after myself. If I don't have enough money, then I have to continue to drive a bus or I have to continue to clean a hospital, risking the illness. But that's my calculation. That's what a neoliberal would say. And in any case, my life is worth less if I am poor, by definition of the economy. Now, this is all completely wrong. It is completely wrong from a human perspective, and it is completely wrong from a social perspective. Somebody has to keep society functioning. If you can isolate yourself by taking the boat and going out to the Caribbean, what you are showing there is that you are not a useful member of society. Society can perfectly well function without you. But if society cannot function without the bus driver and without the hospital cleaner, now we can see who is really valuable, who is really important as a member of our society, who is really necessary. And those are the people who have to be protected. Because by virtue of their profession, by virtue of their social role that we now recognize is essential, they are exposing themselves to the pandemic. So as a collective, we must look at those individuals that are particularly vulnerable and say, we prove our humanity by protecting you first. Just like we prove our humanity by protecting the elderly first, who in and of themselves would be unable to protect and defend themselves, but we protect them as members of society. We protect disabled people first. We protect people with all kinds of special needs first. We protect sick people first. We protect the vulnerable. Now that is the recognition of the collective. It's the recognition that society includes a spectrum of different people with different abilities, different ages, different everything, but we are, at bottom, just one. We are human. That's who we are. And we look after our own, and we do the best that we can for everybody, which is the same thing, the same debate that exists today about how do you allocate vaccines around the world. And the answer has to be you allocate them as generously and as an egalitarian way as possible, because everyone is vulnerable. and the virus replicates everywhere. So we must boost our manufacturing capacity for vaccines. We must distribute those vaccines as rapidly as possible and not by commercial standards. It is shameful that big pharma companies are profiting out of vaccines in the middle of a pandemic. It is absolutely shameful. They did not develop those vaccines alone. They depended on public funding. They depended on the genetic codes that were provided for free by Chinese scientists right at the beginning of the pandemic. They are now pocketing the funds. That is wrong. It is one more instance in which neoliberalism lets humanity down.
And also thanks to the volunteers that participated in their trials, without whom they couldn't have developed those vaccines either. Moving to my next question, the first impression I got from reading the title of your article was that COVID-19 has, quote-unquote, killed neoliberalism. However, once I read the entire article, I realized that you were mostly advocating for, rather than affirming, the end of neoliberalism, given the inefficiencies of neoliberal policies highlighted by the pandemic. Is this the case? If so, you provide some pointers in your article, but can you tell us more about the actions and goals you think that advocacy should aim at?
Once we accept that neoliberalism is generally incompatible with public health, and that neoliberal governments, the more neoliberal governments, have failed miserably in this pandemic, then we are entitled to question neoliberalism itself. Is this a desirable form of organization of society? Is it the kind of society we want to live in? Or do we want something different? And I think despite the pressure of much of the mainstream media and much of public ideology and the discourse of politicians, there is a perception today that is very significant that neoliberalism has led to very poor outcomes in terms of distribution of income and assets and political power. Neoliberalism has led to very negative results in terms of employment and the types of employment that are available. Neoliberalism has been very bad for the youth. Neoliberalism has been very bad for the vulnerable. Neoliberalism has been very bad at so many levels that it's not really a desirable form of organization. The pandemic just makes this even clearer than it was before. And it poses the need to overcome neoliberalism. But this is a political problem. It is a matter of the express preference of the majority of society. If the majority of people are convinced that neoliberalism is not the best way to organize society, and they get themselves organized and push forward to propose, advocate, implement reforms and changes to the ways in which we live, then neoliberalism will be overcome. But if people do not do that, then neoliberalism recharges itself and maintains its domination. The economic crisis of 2007-2008, the great financial crisis, immediately after the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008, it was understood that neoliberalism was gone. Even capitalism was in question, and not just being questioned by the far left, being questioned by the Financial Times and by the economists. The intellectual organs of big capital and big finance capital in particular were questioning, do we have anything left? Can we survive in terms of our social structure and our ownership of assets? But there was no reaction, no significant reaction on the part of the left, on the part of the political forces that could propose alternatives to neoliberalism and could enforce them. And so the consequence was what? Fiscal austerity. The consequence was the restoration of the hegemony of neoliberalism. Now, still they cannot explain what happened. Still the politicians and the neoliberal economists and the ideologues and the journalists cannot come to you straight and say, well, what happened was nothing. We were never wrong. Or we were wrong, but it was something that we have already corrected. No, they can't say either of these things. And they can't explain the disaster of the pandemic either. Why is it that the United States has the largest number of deaths? Why is it that such a disaster has happened in Brazil? Why is it that the UK has been such an embarrassment, except for the vaccination program, the only success in this entire pandemic at the level of the UK, the country where I am based at the moment? The only success has been the vaccination. Everything else has been a complete disaster. Why? Neoliberal ideology, the prejudices of politicians, the dismantling of the state. We have to overcome this. But to do this, we need mass pressure. We need people to be convinced, people to be certain, people to have only an image of the kind of society that they want instead of this one. Because this one is very clear. It doesn't work very well and it kills people unnecessarily. Look at the examples of success in other parts of the world. These are possible. The pandemic was not inevitable. Every single death has to be accounted for because it was avoidable. Look at the successes. We're talking about New Zealand. We're talking about Vietnam. We're talking about Singapore. It is possible to control, to squash, to eliminate the virus. The countries that didn't do that didn't do it out of political choice. They have to be responsible for that. Neoliberalism is particularly responsible for that, and we ought to find ways to transcend it, to build something better.
Your article ends in a very powerful note by saying that, quote, COVID-19 has shown that there can be no health policy without solidarity, industrial policy, and state capacity. This is a desperate fight. We must come out of this crisis with a better society. The left is needed like never before, and it must rise up to the challenge. In your view, what makes the left the best position to engage in such undertaking towards the end of neoliberalism?
In my point of view, the left is defined by a concern with equality. If you're concerned with equality, you're on the left. If instead you're concerned with merit or with efficiency primarily above everything else, then you're on the right. If you're on the left, you'll be concerned with equality and with the build-up of inequalities in human societies. Now, we have achieved, or we have reached a point where inequalities are particularly dramatic. They are at historically high levels. Inequalities of income, of wealth, of power, inequalities of housing, inequalities of employment and employment protection, inequalities in terms of access to goods, access to services, and at the moment, access to health as well. The gradient of differentials in terms of the income levels and the professions of the victims of the pandemic is very, very clear. The poor have suffered disproportionately under this pandemic, not because particularly they are poor, but because they suffer all sorts of disadvantages at the same time, making their health more fragile and their capacity to look after themselves and look after their loved ones much more limited than of economically more privileged people. So neoliberal society is an unequal society. Therefore, from the point of view of the left, it's not a desirable type of society. We want to build societies that are more equal, that recognize the common humanity that we all carry within ourselves. So starting from this point of view, the left has to be, starting from the very definition of neoliberalism as an inequality-generating social system, the left has to be the main force that engages against neoliberalism, that proposes alternatives, and that brings people together to build those alternatives. Now, this doesn't mean that anybody out there has got a recipe of what to do instead of the system that we have at the moment. This is something that emerges in the process of building it. It is particularly urgent today because of the great financial crisis. We're still living with the consequences of the crisis of 2008. It is particularly urgent because of the pandemic. We are now living under the pandemic. We should hopefully emerge out of it in the coming months, but who knows how many months and who knows in what state we're going to emerge. And we are living under neoliberalism in the sense that this is a social and economic system that has destroyed the environment at an unprecedented pace and that will inevitably trigger an environmental collapse around us, compared to which the pandemic is basically nothing. The pandemic is a holiday compared to climate change. Now, climate change cannot be confronted under neoliberalism either. So either we take this lesson from the great financial crisis and now from the pandemic and realize within ourselves that in this way we are walking towards a catastrophe for the entire human species, and then consequently build alternatives, or we will inevitably walk towards a catastrophe and the survival of the species will be at risk in the lifetime of people who exist already in the world today. We are talking about something imminent, very urgent, and that needs to be confronted. Sadly, the policies that are being implemented today to address climate change are insufficient, just like the policies to address the pandemic were insufficient back a year ago. We saw where we ended up in that way. So go in strong, go in hard, go in with public policy capacity, go in with policy coherence, go in mobilizing people on your side, go in explaining what's going on and bring people together. Build up those movements that will be essential to keep us as a species alive, and in doing this, keeping each one of us protected within this society. If we can do this, we have a future. If we don't, if the left does not manage to become much stronger than it is today, then we do have a problem as a species. So in this sense, the left does represent equality, and it represents the possibility of survival as well. It is that dramatic, in my view.
Dr. Alfredo Saad Filho, thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us your time, as well as your knowledge and points of view on this issue.
Thank you very much, Anna, for the invitation. It's great to be here with you.
The conversation continues. If you have a comment that you would like to contribute to today's discussion, please don't hesitate to leave us your opinions in the comment section below. Thanks for listening.